The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Before we begin, I want to alert you to a new website. It's a relatively new website that I've come across. The address is solidarityus.org. Solidarity and then us as in us, .org. It's an anti-Zionist site. But it is also dedicated to activism. It is dedicated to our day-to-day life and how we can fight the mentality of Zionism. It is pro-labor. It has this very strong concept of ethnic and national solidarity around it. And it is a website that I definitely endorse to a great extent. I've been speaking with the president of this organization, and I'm extremely impressed with these people in general. They're putting together a very large march on Washington, and you know, I'm always the first to go after people and their ignorance and arrogance, but I also want to show that there are also some excellent sites out there. And just to be sure, these people have not given me any money or anything like that. But I do want to endorse them, and certainly can attach my name to them, at least for a lot of what these people are saying, and I am extremely proud of them. Anyway, speaking of money, I do accept donations on this show, and I need to make clear that I do not like asking for money. I feel cheap. I feel dirty when I ask for money, but, you know, I have two young children, and this is, for the most part, my full-time occupation as a priest and a writer, and so I, you know, the money is gotten tight recently, and so I ask of you to at least consider a donation, and it will go to things that are centrally concerned with my research, which takes up a huge amount of time on a regular basis. So anyway, those preliminary things out of the way, we will get into the main purpose of this show. As most of you know, the purpose of this show is to promote a very national-specific idea of justice. I am a Russian Orthodox nationalist historian, specializing in Russian and Ukrainian history, but I also do the Western Rite, Western Rite liturgy, that is to say, the liturgy of St. Gregory, prior to the changes which crept into the liturgy after the 10th century in the West. And at the moment, I serve under the Greek Orthodox Old Calendar Synod, which originally comes from Auxentius, but now is represented in Athens by Archbishop Angelos, in Moscow by Metropolitan Raphael, in Ukraine, in Bukovina, under Bishop Unifiri, who was a underground catacomb bishop in the church, and the group under Raphael was also a underground catacomb Orthodox group in Russia, and the Alternative Synod in Bulgaria, which is a synod that rejected the Communist Party's election of Patriarch Maxim, and of course my own spiritual father, Metropolitan John in New Jersey. We are the true Orthodox Church of the Patristic Observance, to be more specific. And we are by far the largest true Orthodox group in the world. We have about 500 parishes and about 2,500 monastics worldwide. And we're completely dedicated to the unity of all true Orthodox groups. And we accept the sacraments of all true Orthodox groups. And I, for one, do not think in terms of jurisdictions I think that's a form of idolatry. I think really in terms of communities and in the doctrines that they uphold. Now, the question of nationalism has come up many times. A lot of Orthodox people are hostile to it, but I think they're hostile to it largely because they're not educated and they don't understand what the word actually means. And today, we're going to dedicate the entire show to a particular writer of the middle of the 19th century who only rarely gets spoken of, and that is Alfonsi Shapov. I have not found tons of stuff on him in English, but I have read him in Russian. And his political theory is one of a nationalist and agrarian approach to communal life. When I use the term nationalism, I am going back to the founder of nationalist social theory, which is the mid to late 18th century German writer, Johann Herder. I have a show on Herder and his students, so to speak, in Russia, Komiakov and Kedivsky, Aksakov, forming the Slavophile school in Russia, and the Ukrainian nationalist movement under people like Shevchenko in that part of the world. It is a humane, almost a national anarchist style of agrarian thinking, but nationalism has gotten bound up with an obsession with the state, which itself, too, is a matter of idolatry. Overarching state power is condemned in the Old Testament when Solomon attempted to use forced labor, these huge, grandiose building projects. We raised taxes the symbolism of numbering the population, measuring the population, the symbol is that of overarching state control. Solomon died a heretic, and I'm shocked to find some Orthodox people who think that Solomon was this saint of some kind. I've even seen icons of Solomon, and yet he died a pagan, and he died a heretic. That movement is represented in Russia by Peter the Great. Peter the Great was a rather extraordinary revolutionary, and there is a lot of evidence that he was a Satanist, that he worshipped Lucifer as the god of enlightenment, which he was bringing onto Russia. And he did so with a mass slaughter of Cossacks in the building of St. Petersburg and his war against nature. And St. Petersburg was quite literally built on top of tens of thousands of dead Ukrainian and Russian Cossacks. Peter the Great was not a Christian, although, of course, he had to spout the line. I don't think Catherine the Great was either. And I've said many times on this show that, to a great extent, the Orthodox life died out in Russia in the 18th century. And it was maintained by a few old believers, by a few people doing the new right who had rejected this redevelopment of the state and the imposition of the state upon all of Russia. The old believers developed into a political movement precisely because of Peter. And the radical changes in the Russian state in the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century, where the state then became radically alienated from the land or from the thousands of communes that were the very cellular structure of Russian society. Alfonsi Shapov is somebody who promoted the concept of a political old believerism, and his approach to Russian history and nationalism is one that I personally accept. And he doesn't get spoken of very much. He doesn't get spoken of because he is a nationalist as well as a Christian socialist. The old believers also had this point of view. St. Ambrose, so many of the church fathers rejected the idea of economic inequality. It was very much a part of the early patristic mind. And so many of these corrupt bishops in the church who will, you know, yak on about how they want to follow the fathers. And the minute you mention to them St. Ambrose on justice or St. John Chrysostom on Lazarus and the rich man, where they condemn private property and they condemn this kind of economic oligarchy and inequality, suddenly these well-off bishops aren't so interested in the church fathers anymore. And I found that to be a problem about how many of these Orthodox people claim to be interested in the canons and the church fathers, except when they become very inconvenient, and then they get thrown out the window. So most of these people have a tendency to be very selective as to what church fathers they read or what canons they adhere to. Alphonse Schiappa wrote throughout the 1840s, 50s, and 60s as well, and he died in 1876. And he is one of the founders and leaders of this kind of libertarian nationalism that is meant to challenge the state not from the point of view of the individual, but from the point of view of the region and the local commune. And he points out that many of the violent outbursts of the Russian peasantry largely were confined to the sectarians. That would include the old believers who were strictly Orthodox, but other semi-Christian and non-Christian sects as well had made some inroads into Russian life. Now, I don't want to go to the extreme and say that everyone who followed the New Right and Peter the Great were heretics. Peter the Great was personally a demonist, but and a high-level Mason as well. But I do believe there were many good people, of course. This is not a matter of jurisdiction. Talking in terms of jurisdiction is falsehood. We talk in terms of communities and the faith and monasticism. The monks produce the bishops. The bishops are taken from monks, and therefore the monastery is superior to the bishop, at least in terms of basic moral authority, if not administrative authority. Schiappa's whole work was to take the old believer mentality and unpack its nationalist approach. This nationalist approach, as I said, is found in the German writings of Herder, who hit Russia very hard and was taken very seriously by the Slavophiles, but no one more seriously than Schiappa. Schiappa was a Christian socialist and nationalist in that nationalism implies a solidarity that means that the economic goods of the society should be enjoyed by those who make them, not by those, as in capitalism, who manipulate them. He was a populist where other forms of national movements like Leontiev and Pobedonostiev are more state-oriented. I mean, there's good and bad in all of these movements. But this kind of agrarian, non-possessorite nationalism is something absolutely sacred to me. And the memory of Neil Sorsky, for example, whose form of monasticism was forcibly stamped out in the 18th century and did not revitalize really until the rebuilding of Sarov and Optina, which were built on the hesychastic movement from Athos and by St. Paisia in particular. And this movement, and sometimes historians of Russia forget this, this movement was condemned in no uncertain terms by the bishops and the official church. Both the phenomenon of eldership and the phenomenon of hesychasm were condemned in the treatment that these monastics had meted out to them by the synod. The synod had become so alien from orthodoxy in the middle of the 18th century, they had been purged and functionaries largely put in their place, that, as is always the case in these times of crisis, the church was reduced to monasteries and the extended family and commune. These have always been the cellular structure of the church, and these administrations and synods have simply used them as a cash cow. And I need to warn Orthodox people to not fetishize the synod, not to fetishize the state. You fetishize it when you turn it into an idol and believe that they have power that they do not have. A synod is merely an administrative body. It presupposes the existence of the church as a unity. It is not in and of itself the church in its unity. It only presupposes it and exists only to protect it, not to rule it. And there's a lot of vulgarity amongst Orthodox people, especially new converts, who see a bishop as just a little pope over his diocese. That is not true. First of all, the office of bishop is a synod in and of itself. The synodia exists at the level of the church universal, a national church, and at each diocesan, monastic, and parish level. These are always collective entities. So when a bishop writes a circular, the tradition is that he refers to himself as plural. We say this because it is a synodia of the diocese, not the bishop. that is in charge. It is the monastic tradition, the parishes, all of this producing this kind of general will of the faith. The bishop only represents it. For the most part, bishops are parasites on the church. There have been many saintly bishops in the past, but that should not blind us to the fact that bishops have traditionally been greedy and grasping and live far better than most of the parishes under their charge. In the Russian case, that was extremely bad in the middle of the 18th century, where the good bishops and good people had been purged from the church. And as always the case, like Serbia and Bulgaria under the Turks, it was the monastic communities and the extended family where the faith was maintained. Don't exaggerate this. Sometimes I get emails about this show and people just hear what they want to hear or what they could understand. Fact is that bishops are needed, but they are a necessary evil. They are to the church what the state is to the country. You know, the state exists because it presupposes an ethnic and linguistic unity in a general sense of the term. It is not that unity. States, bishops, they're parasitic on an underlying unity of the church that is called in Russian subornost and Ukrainian subunopravna, and it's the idea not of the council, but what the council in the synod presupposes. Subornost is not the same thing as conciliarity. That is falsehood, and it's a problem with a lot of amateurs trying to deal with this stuff. They're not properly prepared to deal with the metaphysics of Plato and the Neoplatonists that were so deep into the early church fathers as almost a prophetic utterance from these men prior to the advent of Christ. Let me make something clear here before we get into the meat of Shiapov. I spent a lot of time condemning the endless pretentiousness that you find in people, especially in religious bodies, as they write in the blogs and everything else. And I've warned you to stay away from them because they are incredibly ignorant in their pomposity. But more specifically, you can't deal with the church and the church fathers without first being well-versed in metaphysics in general. The metaphysics of the Western philosophical tradition from Plato onward, that's necessary first before you begin reading somebody, an ancient figure like John of Damascus, or a more contemporary figure like Theophon the Recluse, because they're using a vocabulary that presupposes that you know the basic history of metaphysics and epistemology. You can't just pick up St. John of Damascus. If you want to get deep into this people, you have to study the Greek philosophers first, and then that will... because they're using a vocabulary that goes back to these people. When they use words like hypostasis or physis or, you know, these kind of things, nous, these are all words that were first defined in the ancient world, and they presuppose that you know what these things are. So the amateurism is when someone just tries to pick up someone like St. Basil and thinks that he knows anything. Basil is assuming that you are well-versed in ancient Greek science and ancient Greek metaphysics. And the church fathers were as influential as they were because they were masters of Greek philosophy, Greek science, Greek mathematics, and Greek ontology, as St. Basil's Hexameron, for example, strongly suggests. And so you have a lot of people who are quoting the fathers because it promotes a certain agenda of theirs, but you have to be very careful. You do not deal with the church fathers before you have become a fairly well-versed student in Plato and Aristotle, the Stoics, Plotinus, etc. It's a lot like in the discipline of astronomy. To become an astronomer, you don't start reading astronomy your freshman year of college. You get a degree in physics, then you do your graduate work in astronomy. It's the same thing here. You study the history of philosophy first, and then that will give you the grounding and the vocabulary that you need to then interpret the later church fathers. And you know, what's happening now in Orthodoxy is really just a shame. There are schisms upon schisms. Very few of these schisms have anything to do with the faith. they are, for the most part, about protecting property and assets. But this is what bishops do. And they need to be held in great suspicion. They should be the products of monasteries, and therefore the monastic synodia is really the heart and soul of the diocese. If the monastery is to produce a bishop, the bishop, therefore, cannot claim to be superior to what created him. He may have an administrative authority, but the real authority of the church is a synodia, which presupposes a broader unity of the Orthodox faith at the local level. Now, I spent a lot of time explaining that to people. I want to avoid anyone falling into this trap that a young man will pick up Basil's Hexameron or Ambrose's On the Holy Spirit and thinks that he understands it. It's deceptive because without knowing Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics, you can't make sense out of anything that they're talking about, because they're using words in a technical, ontological sense, and if you don't know what they are, you don't know what's being said. It's no different than with the Scriptures. Old Testament, New Testament, without having a firm knowledge of the ancient world, the nature of the prophetic utterance in the Old Testament, nothing in the New makes any sense. This is how it has to be done. You start with the history of metaphysics first, and then you pick up people like Basil, because then the Hexameron can be more skillfully interpreted. Otherwise, it's just the ego trying to sound like an intellectual when, in fact, they're not. Now, and what makes it worse is because, you know, when you make a religious decision, you're betting your soul here. And these guys yakking on the blogs, muddying the waters, if people believe that they have the authority that they do not have, they could end up betting their soul on the wrong horse. The fact is that these people, yakkers on the blogs, they can do a tremendous amount of damage, because many of their pretentious utterances has the basic structure of authority when in fact it's mostly just smoke and mirrors. Now, I say all of this because Shiapov presupposes all of this. His point of view stresses the fact that when you use a word like subornost, you cannot claim that that's translated as conciliarity. No, a council presupposes the existence of a greater unity. When we're talking about a word like subornos, we're referring to something very specific. It is the uncreated grace manifest from the resurrection of Christ, made clear to us through the Holy Spirit. It is uncreated grace. It is energy. It is light. It is essence. These are all the same thing. They're referring to the same thing, referring to the presence of Logos, light, which all communities are organized around to the extent, number one, they profess the proper doctrine, and number two, they live the ascetic life. That's what's presupposed in a word like subornost, not a council. A council might try to manifest that presence, but that presence, as uncreated, as permanent, is in fact the very light that made Eden what it was prior to the fall. It is paradise. It exists here and now in the church, and those ascetics who have reached it describe it, and they describe it in great detail. It is present here, but that is subordinate. That is what the word presupposes, and that is the nature of the unity on earth that the church, universal, national, and local, all is there to understand, describe, and to protect. Everybody's job is to do that. A bishop might do it from an administrative point of view, but that is it. Other than that, it is the uncreated entity that is equally available to all Orthodox people so long as they lead the ascetic life. It is to go beyond the realm of cause and effect and see nature for what it is in its essence, which is Logos. Okay, that's the introduction to Shiapov, because again, he's using this kind of terminology in dealing with the nature of unity, something that a government or a synod does not create. It only imperfectly represents. So we'll get into the more specific elements of his social theory and that of the very concept of subordinost when we return.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are dealing here today with the metaphysics and politics of Afanasy Shchiapov, the great Russian writers in the middle of the 19th century. And we're talking about the concept of subordinost and how amateur writers kind of misdefine it and kind of fit it into some kind of Western concept of external unity. The amateurs out there have done a lot of damage and are very pretentious because they act as if they have the authority that in fact they don't have. And they can do damage and they can introduce falsehood in their simplicity. Shchiapov is somebody that can only be understood once you make sense out of the light, the essence, the form, or the uncreated energies of the Trinity manifest on earth, and that is the church. It is not the church body, it is not the synod, it is not the bishop, it is not the priest. We are all within that uncreated grace. It is logos in nature, it is energy when it comes to the Trinity as a whole. It is something that is accessible to those Orthodox people who struggle and who live the life of the ascetic so that they could make themselves prepared to see that light for what it is. And too many of the saints, including in our own present time, have described it. And hence, empirically speaking, we're forced to accept that this is how it is. But this is something that Shchiapov expects that his readers understand. This is the very center of Orthodox mysticism, especially people like Isaac of Syria, who in the Russian Middle Ages is probably the single most read church father. In fact, so many of the inventories of monasteries and printing presses, sometimes the only church father that they reproduce is Isaac of Syria. And so this question of light, form, subordinost, energy, grace, it's all one thing. It is all the presence of God in the world, and that is the church. Our doctrine and our practices only approximate what it is in and of itself. Now, Shchiapov holds that Slavs are a chosen people of sorts, not because of some intrinsic merit, but because the main idea of Slavdom is decentralist structures. No other race of people, he says, manifests that singular virtue of decentralization. Democracy is a word, of course, abused and overused. It can only refer to local subordinost, and where governments and councils and assemblies incompletely represent that kind of Rousseauian general will, which I do believe has strong echoes of the Platonic idea of form. Self-governed, decentralist communities, largely agrarian, highly religious, these are the very cells of the Russian way of thinking, the Russian way of life. The state is the formal structures of power. Government is the authority, the unity that is only presupposed by any kind of external structure. The result of all this is that the Muscovite centralization under people like Ivan III, Basil III, Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, is unnatural. It's something not normal to Slavs. And yet, because of the external violence of Russia's enemies, Turks, Mongols, Poles, Lithuanians, etc., this state, to some extent created through Tartar and Mongol influence, is something that developed and became parasitic on the land as a whole. That is the central core of the Slavophile movement, and is a central core of Shapov and the concept of subordinost. Now, an article came out in 1978 in the Russian Review concerning the so-called federal school in Russian legal history. And the argument is that the folklore movement, the romantic folklore movement, which came directly out of the work of Johann Herder in Germany, revolutionized how human beings see society. The fact is that the peasants were not this silent, ignorant group of people. Their folk songs and poetry and pantomimes and things like that that they did were politically quite sophisticated. They were deeply Christian, they were deeply agrarian, populist, decentralist, and yet they never deviated from their love of royalism in general. Nationalism here is the inner development of the people. And Shapov and others writing on him really stress the idea that the old believer movement was primarily social and political, that the regime had become distant from the common population, that the new nobility recruited to serve the state had no relationship with the common population, and even in the 18th century began speaking French. What he wanted to promote was the idea of the Zemensky Sobor, or the Council of the Land, where the basic unity of the people and every local area can send delegates to the main Sobor in St. Petersburg. And that the country should be ruled by popular regional assemblies, and that these represent all of the major social and professional groups in the region. And that this becomes an incomplete manifestation of the unity and solidarity of the people. The peasants are the real builders of Russia. This is central to all forms of nationalism and national traditionalism throughout the Slavic world. The old appanage systems of Russia, or the old princes prior to the centralization of Moscow, these were expressions of coherent regions. It was not a Russia that had fallen apart. It is a Russia at its root. Russia is a broader society based on this series of regional identities, such as Novgorod, Pskov, Tver, Moscow, Galicia, etc., each with its own economy, each with its own specific dialect, with its own favorite saints, and everything else. For him, democracy is the same thing as representation, but it is a general will that gets represented. Think of it this way. You look at any community, let's say our Russian Orthodox community in America. You try to describe what they are. What are their core beliefs and views? How do they live their lives every day? What is the purpose of prayer and asceticism? How they assist the needy, how they build orphanages and everything else, nursing homes and everything else we do. What is all of that? Is that reducible to sentences on a page? Is that reducible to our actual actions and doing good things or praying or whatever it is? No. Those physical things are only manifestations of something else. That something else is not material. That's something else, that core of what they are all doing. This is quite immaterial, and it is the energy of the Holy Spirit on earth. It is the energy of the Trinity. The central core as to what we do, this radio show, for example, it's only one tiny aspect of a much larger community that is never reducible to individuals and their actions. They are only aspects of it. They are only expressions of it. But what is it? And that is that light, that form, that makes reading Plato and Plotinus of immense significance, at least as a gateway into learning about how we view God and how we view the world. So for him, really, and only the state that had legitimacy is one that takes all of the regions of Russia and or of any country. And this is similar to people like John Calhoun in the American South, who saw this plural executive, a way to bring all of the regional and professional bodies under one roof that centralizes authority only in military matters, but leaves everything else to the regions. This is a so-called federal school of Russian history. And these old appanage princes in these different cities They represent a real regional mentality. They had their own Vieshera popular assembly. They had their own urban and rural way of life. And it was all throughout Russia, either the agrarian commune on the one hand or the urban artel or labor commune on the other hand. This was deeply Slavic, and this existed prior to the advent of Christianity. Christianity only put it on a more rational and literate footing. Shapov is writing at a time where the end of serfdom has led to a complete reevaluation of the Russian way of life. There's a whole argument out there that peasants were better off as serfs than they were as a part of the commune just by itself. After 1861, there were peasant uprisings straight up and through the 20th century. Many of them were old believer or other kind of sectarian, so to speak, movements. And there was a religious element to it. But the over-centralization of the state and the attachment of this new nobility to the state alienated the land completely. And that's the problem. Now, it's true later on he did change his view, and he put more importance on central authorities, especially when it came to defending the people from the raids of the nomads, for example, the Tartars and others like that. But it did not harm his primary thesis. He wrote a paper in 1867. It's the 6 years after the serfs were freed. It's called The General View of the History of Intellectual Development in Russia. And he divides all cultures into two specific stages. The first stage is the physical. This is where the inbreeding begins. This is where the language develops, basic customs and traditions, the struggles and sufferings of a people, and how that manifests itself in these cultural markers that we talk about all the time. These cultural markers, like language, they are not the core of the people, the soul of the people. They're manifestations of that immaterial object. But then the second stage is the scientific stage, is where the society can produce enough economic surplus to begin creating a more bureaucratic and administrative establishment, that the intellectual classes become alienated from the common run of the peasant, and they begin to see themselves as superior to the peasant. This is the problem. It isn't as if every society and every region within that society has its own definition of progress. Progress is dependent on the climate, whether the soil is good or bad, whether it's cold or warm, whether it's mountainous or not. These are absolutely essential to understanding how a group of people comes into existence. The real fall, though, the fall from grace here, is where that kind of culture becomes a civilization. A civilization is a point of alienation where an elite class joins with the state and rules without reference to the people as a whole. And the fact is that what people like Shapov are forcing Russian nationalists and monarchists to view is why were the rebellions against royal authority under Alexis and under Catherine, these rebellions, the Razin and Pugachev rebellions, these included millions of Russian peasants, most of whom were old believers, against the established church and the established state. These were popular rebellions, and Russian historians have to take them seriously. They were not rebelling against monarchy because their official proclamations were royalist. They were not fighting against orthodoxy because, again, their official proclamations were very orthodox. They were doing battle against this new elite, closely connected to foreign centers of power, speaking a different language, ruling the country from a distant capital, having nothing to do with the day-to-day life of the people. This is the nature of Razin or Pugachev. It was where the natural regional bodies of a people, manifesting, albeit imperfectly, the soul of the people, so to speak, that immaterial essence that is only expressed in language and in institutions, but is not that which is expressed. That is immaterial. They rule without reference to that. They rule without reference to the traditions of the land. And I've said many times in my contribution, so to speak, to to nationalist political theory is that ethnic markers are coping mechanisms where a people, they've created this and have become dependent on it to bring them through times of struggle. That's an ethnic group. Speaking the same language, having the same basic general moral point of view, religion, etc. But its political punch comes from the fact that these groups go through suffering, slavery or genocide or whatever it is, and many ethnic groups have gone through this, and that suffering creates the structures that become nationalism. These structures are coping mechanisms, and these people become closer and closer. Just like in any family, family comes through tough times, it comes out of it, it comes out of it stronger than before, because they held together through difficult times. And ethnicity as a political and economic reality, subordinate in its true sense, has a secular element where the ethnic group comes through suffering, comes through this period of its physical growth. And of course, that is completed by the presence of the church or the recreation of Eden, which exists from Christ's resurrection and available only to the saints. There's another paper called Whirling with the Other, Russian Populism and Religious Sects, which came out in Russian Review in 2003. Shapov sees the Russian peasant and the Orthodox peasant everywhere. I mean, in Russia, because it's by far the largest Orthodox country, the Russian peasant as a symbol, as an icon of Christ's suffering. They're humiliated, they're beaten, they're attacked. And just like in America, where farmers are called ignorant hicks, and that makes it easy for the urban elite to steal from them, to destroy their livelihoods, and because they have been reduced to ignorant hicks or whatever they're called, it justifies and makes them less than human, and therefore exploiting them is no problem. The central core of all of this is that there is a soul of a people. It is to be found in the specific regions. Each region has to maintain its own council, its own assembly. They only incompletely manifest that immaterial core of the population. But that is the only source of political legitimacy. Rousseau's idea of the general will is very much a deracinated version of that. But the general will is not identical to those areas of agreement and solidarity in a people. It is beyond that. It is what makes that solidarity possible in the first place. It is what makes culture and government possible in the first place. That concept of unity that slowly manifests itself in the physical stage and soon becomes part of the scientific stage. The scientific stage need not be alienated. In Russia, it occurred at the end of the reign of Tsar Alexis and really only finished itself in the middle of the 18th century. And this led to destruction of the monasteries, secularization of the church, and only through the monastic revival, we had parts of Western Ukraine on Manyava, which maintained some of the old hesychastic way of life. Then the Athanite movement, which came in with people like Paisiy Verkhovsky, and manifests itself in places like Sarov and Optina, it was resurrected. But it was resurrected on a non-possessor basis. The idea of the national anarchist and agrarian communalism, which lies at the core of the Russian Orthodox Church as a social institution, and the political thought of the Slavophiles, and here, what we're dealing with now, Alfons de Shiapov. And what we're dealing with is the fact that the individual is an abstraction. The individual exists only because it has been born and raised within a very specific culture and language. The individual becomes a self in a healthy culture. It becomes an ego in an unhealthy culture. A self is that middle position between complete collectivization on the one hand and complete anarchic and chaotic individualism on the other. Both of those are unhealthy. Sometimes a scientific stage of life produces egos. It need not. You need to remember that you know, prior to the rise of the Old Believers and the creation of the so-called New Russian Rite in 1665, 1666, many of the Old Believer leaders were, in fact, correctors of the old books. Correction of the old books wasn't the problem. It changed its spirit. It wasn't just a matter of correcting the old books. Avakum himself was a book corrector. No, the spirit changed. Suddenly, these people began to claim that we are only students of the Greeks, and the Greek books coming in from Italy in both Greek and Latin translation, this is what we have to follow. And the old believers said, no, we have our own culture, and this culture represents our sufferings, and that is the nature of our solidarity. As Christ suffered, his church suffers, his Russian people suffer. And only through that will we be purged, and only through that will we become strong. And a drill sergeant in the army doesn't treat his students poorly because he enjoys it. He does it because only through that kind of suffering do these people have any chance of surviving warfare. So we need to be very careful. Orthodox people, they throw words like subornos and subornopravna around. They have no clue of the intense mystic tradition that lies at the root of it. The word mystic, like so many other words, it's mystified and totally overused. The concept of mystic is the same as the concept of participation. What our family is to our overarching culture is what an object is to its universal expression. All individuals only become individuals because they partake of something greater than themselves. The life of the spirit, which is the life of the church, of the monastic life, of asceticism, and of the ethnic expression which exists to protect it. This is the sort of nationalism that I am talking about here. The taking of the physical markers, the way that Shapov defines this, the kind of appropriation of the landscape, humanizing the organic life around it, and then from that, once there is a certain economic surplus, that then this can become a civilization. That need not be this revolutionary schism that you had with Peter the Great. And I've said to the old believers that I don't think Nikon is really the problem. I think Peter the Great is the problem. That the old believers would never have become as large as they did without the complete separation of government from the people that you had under Peter the Great. And that people like Tsar Nicholas I attempted to fix that schism. And since he did not move back to Moscow and did not liberate the church from that kind of state tutelage, which, by the way, can be exaggerated, but that's a separate issue. He did not do that, and therefore that ended up failing. The old believers were not all that upset when the rather humane reign of Tsar Nicholas II came to an end in 1918. The old believers maintained what was best in the Russian Orthodox tradition, and because of that, they maintained subornost. And bishops usually want to control people, not govern them in the legitimate sense of that word, and that's why they become a problem. We use words like subornos in the way that Shapov has used it. They're using it in the same sense that Isaac of Syria and others have used it. It is the presence of the uncreated energies of God on earth. It's what makes nature this extraordinarily complex organic organism, as opposed to the Enlightenment idea where nature is just a machine. And we go beyond the purely mechanistic idea, which is strictly an allegory that gets imposed on nature. The machine culture can't look at anything in the world that's anything but a machine. The human mind, the human body, nature as a whole, is just seen as a machine. That's a metaphor that does not describe what nature truly is as logos. Okay. We are done for the day. I appreciate you guys listening. I know this has been somewhat difficult, but we are not dealing with easy topics here. We're going to the core of what a people really is. So I appreciate you guys listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into Radio Aryan.